Welcome back to Truth About Muslims podcast.
That was so cheesy. Stop.
We got Peter Riddell in the studio, and Trevor is always making fun of my intros.
Yeah, it's part three, guys, in a three-part series, and really this is this part of the series where we ask, so what?
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of people don't understand, well, why study history?
Right, and I think this is the most exciting part. And it might not be the most exciting story-wise, but I think as far as practical application, I think that's important. And I want to know what history should, you know, how it should inform how I act or think towards Muslims today.
Yeah, and I think it's helpful, like Dr. Riddell has laid out for us so far, that as Christians, it is helpful to look at people of other faiths and their religion and their history, and then also our interactions. And so this episode really helps us to understand what's going on today in the context and in the chain of events, as we've been talking about over this three-part series, the chain of events that what came before a particular link and what comes after. And so anytime you see something on the news, recognize that particular event has a chain that goes before it, and that particular event will affect the links coming after. And I think that's a really neat way to look at history.
Right. Well, we hope you enjoy.
Once again, Muslim terrorists.
A terrorist
slaughtered
attack.
Innocent
Islamic
people.
Extremists now control
terrorists.
Much of the country.
The
Their brand of justice is brutal and deadly.
Newsflash, America. These Muslim extremists are alive and well. They are not dead. And their video is not gratuitous. And it certainly is not irrelevant. It is a warning.
Welcome to the Truth About Muslims podcast, the official podcast of the Zwemer Center for Muslim Studies, where we help to educate you beyond the media. Here are your hosts, Howard and Trevor.
Do Christians need to ask for forgiveness for the Crusades? Is that part of our reconciliation with Muslims and decreasing that tension? And what would you say?
Well, I'm a great believer in repentance and reconciliation. At the same time, I believe that if you have two communities that have a history of conflict between themselves, then both sides need to jointly repent and be involved in reconciliation, because if only one side involves itself in the reconciliation, it risks the other saying, you see, we were right all along, you guys did the wrong thing. So I think Christians and Muslims should meet together, talk about history, to discuss history and each account for how they've contributed to the problems of the present day.
So I read a recent scholar that we're both familiar with say it seems a bit silly to, he didn't word it this way necessarily, but it seems a bit silly to ask forgiveness for Crusades and then just to keep doing them. And this came from a Middle Eastern scholar that is a believer and studies Islam as well, but says, you know, we can apologize for the Crusades, but they just keep coming, so what's the point? And he obviously was referencing the United States and its foreign policy, and that he sees that, and that the Muslim world sees that, as just an ongoing crusade. What are your thoughts about that, as a good Australian?
I think my first response would be to say, well, let's not accept at face value the comparison. If you're going to compare things, you want to make certain that you're comparing like with like. And the Crusades were sanctioned by the Pope in Rome. He issued forgiveness to any people who took part, a remission for their sins. There was definitely a huge theological dimension to the whole crusade project in the Middle Ages. That's quite different to what's going on today. Now, that's not to justify issues of today, but for me, that kind of statement is comparing apples with oranges. I don't think it's that helpful. I think if you're going to make a comparison, it's not helpful to make sloppy comparisons, and for me that's a sloppy comparison, to be honest.
I kind of had an Australian question. Something in Australian history that's really interesting to me is Anzac Day. The Australians had this huge battle with the Turks. But then I've heard of reports where they actually celebrated, I think it was during World War II or something like that, they actually celebrated, they were on the same side, the Turks and the Australians, in this point, and they actually celebrated Anzac Day together. honoring one another for their bravery, because it was a crazy battle. It was a crazy, bloody battle. But they didn't hate each other. They didn't hold that. And I know maybe you can't say anything to this, but, you know, as an Australian, like Americans, we just don't do that. So what would you say is different about the in that situation? Why would, you know, a battle like that, and it was bloody, lots of loss on both sides, how can they come together and still be, you know, they're buying each other beers and stuff and just, you know, like enjoying each other's company? And how does that happen in today's world?
Mm. Yeah. When I was growing up, Anzac Day was celebrated then as it is now, but in the days when I was growing up, Anzac Day was clearly a day to remember the Australian involvement, along with the British and others, Indians. Australian involvement and Australian loss. So, in other words, to commemorate what was actually a military defeat for the Australians and the Brits and the Indians, but nevertheless to commemorate our loss. Now, what's happened since then, and I'm talking there in the 60s and 70s and so forth, what's happened since then is... there has been the development of a very large Turkish community in Australia. So no longer were the Turks this foreign group over there in Turkey, but we have a large Turkish community in Sydney, large Turkish community in Melbourne with mosques and so forth. And so they also, for them, the attack on Gallipoli is very significant, and they are also Australian. So all of a sudden, the memory of the campaign at Gallipoli, fighting between Australians and Turks, is relevant to both Anglo-Australians and Turkish Australians. So the memory of Anzac Day has metamorphosed over the years. So, for example, we found this year that at the centenary celebrations of Anzac Day that were held in different parts of Australia and over in Turkey, there were Turkish speakers, there were Anglo-Australian speakers commemorating the joint experience of battle and loss. It's very healthy in a way.
So it goes along with kind of what you're saying, knowing individual stories, knowing people, not just stereotypes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know. I just find that would not happen in the U.S. We have large groups of Muslim population in the U.S., and yet they're still separated. They're so different. There was that other thing and that happened on Australia was the Come Ride With Me, hashtag Come Ride With Me campaign, where somebody was, or it was during the cafe hostage situation. And somebody had posted on Facebook their story, or Twitter, their story of this Muslim woman that was on the train or the bus, subway, something like that, public transportation, and they were watching the news, and it was about the hostage situation. And the woman just pulled off her head covering and just started weeping. And the woman felt really compassionate. The one who's writing this on the Twitter sat next to her and said, you know, I'm here with you. I'll ride with you. Don't take this off. Put it back on. You know, just kind of in camaraderie, standing next to her, you know. And when she got off the bus, the lady gave her a long hug and then wandered away, never put her head covering back on. And then after that, it was just like 150,000 tweets of hashtag I'll ride with you, just like saying, hey, if there's any Muslims that don't feel safe in public transportation, I'm at this bus stop, I'm this, and just tweeting all over the place. But that was in Australia. I don't see that happening in the U.S.,
Yeah, I mean, I can't comment on the U.S. I don't know the situation as well, but that was quite a famous series of incidents surrounding that Lindt Cafe hostage situation.
Right.
Ironically, I mean, it was tragic because two people were killed in that hostage situation, mm-hmm. and yet that loss led to some warm relationships between Muslims and non-Muslims in other ways. It's tragically ironic.
Yeah. I guess I just want to know your thoughts, just because Australia seems to be doing some things, you know, much better than the U.S. as far as when it comes to Muslim relations.
Hmm.
So,
and that's what we see in the news. Is it a fair assessment? Are you guys doing well with your Muslim immigrant communities? Is there good relationships, or does it have as much tension as what you see here in the United States? Because you've been here a few times and seen and... You know, we talk and you're aware of the ongoing tension here with the immigrant communities and Muslims. How is it in Australia?
Hey, ladies. I'm from Truth About Muslims podcast. Have you heard of it?
Yeah.
Okay. So we want you to read an ad for us. Can you do that? You'll be famous, like world famous. It'll be amazing.
CIU.
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 I'm Kevin Kakaisen.
Kevin.
Yeah, Kevin.
Oh, wow. Nice. You just
Luke
Fain.
Luke Fain.
Luke.
All right.
CIU educates people from a biblical worldview to impact the nations with the message of Christ.
You want to read that again?
Yeah.
You're like, I'll be so embarrassed if you read that.
Well, it varies. You get many cases of joint activities. You get dialogue groups. You get joint cultural activities. So there are some very good things going on. But of course, we also have, as Britain is having, and as many European nations are having, we have a minority of Muslim radicals in Australia. Australia's got, by recent accounts, the proportion of young Muslims who've left Australia to join ISIS is one of the highest proportions in the Western world.
Wow.
So that's causing concern. So it's a mixed story, you see. Now, having said that, a number of young people have been detained at airports on the trying to exit the country to go and join ISIS in Syria, and they've been detained because of tip-offs to the security authorities from other Muslims as well. So you see, it's a mixed story. So we do have a problem with Muslim radicalism, but some other Muslims are helping out in dealing with the problem. So, yeah, we've got problems, but we've got some good things happening as well.
So looking at the whole of history, the entire chain, the rise of political Islam, what are some of the main turning points, just looking back, that we need to at least spend a little bit of time swimming in those points of history in order to understand current day trends within Islam?
Yeah. Another, there are a number of myths in history. I suppose I should preface what I'm about to say by just reminding our listeners about the difference between statements of opinion and statements of fact. One of the things one has to do in history is to present statements of opinion, but we should indicate that their opinion, not facts. So, for example, if I say that New York is a huge city, that's a statement of fact. If I say New York's the best city in the United States, it's a statement of opinion.
Probably depends who you ask.
Probably. So with history, we often have to make statements of opinion, but we should indicate that they're our opinions. Now, where is this leading to? In my view, in my opinion, the rise of political Islam in recent times is merely a rerun of what has happened at different points of history. Sometimes you hear commentators say, radical Islam, political Islam is a 21st century phenomenon. I just don't agree with that. What I see is the history of Islam is like a wave. It's like a chain, but it's also like a wave with peaks and troughs. And what strikes me when I look at the history of Islam over the 14 centuries of its existence is that when, after a peak, after a period of glory and greatness, and you hit a trough, at the period of the trough, you find a call to return to the text, to the basics, or a call to return to Islamic law, to return to the example of the Prophet, to literally follow the call of the text. Now, that happened in the 1200s when great Islamic Empire was destroyed by the Mongol invasions, and all of a sudden you found these writers emerging in the 1300s who sound very much like the radical writers today. I'm thinking of particular names. For the purpose of your listeners who may know, people like Ibn Taymiyyah and Ibn Kathir and so forth, these are radical writers in their own day. Likewise, in the late 1700s, you find a period of decline, and so the Wahhabis emerge. The Wahhabi movement emerges in that period. In the 1900s, you find the radicals emerging, as we have seen in our own day. And so for me, you're talking about turning points or key moments in history. The troughs in Islamic history are key because that's when the radicals emerge. And they emerge in response to perceived weakness of Islam at the time.
So that does kind of answer our questions about whether Islam is on the rise or decline. When you look at the troughs, if they do come back to radicalism, but I guess the same could be said about Christianity too, because we do have that kind of text. The U.S. needs to repent. We hear that kind of stuff all the time. Mm. If this is because of the abortion or because of homosexuality or
prayer in schools.
Oh yeah, prayer in schools. This is the judgment of the Lord, coming down to the U.S. But it seems it feels kind of ethnocentric to me in that regard. But in terms of Islam, it makes sense.
So what is the first trough? In the first rise, would you point back to the argument with the Mu'tazilites in is it the Carterites that really is the sort of beginnings of this? And this is just that same argument being replayed throughout history?
Well, yeah. I mean,
and you got to give some explanation to some background to these two groups.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you mentioned the Kharijites. They were the Kharijiyya. They were crucial. In a sense, they were the first radicals in Islam. And they emerged in the middle of the 600s because, in their view, the Islamic caliph at the time was taking part in a process of negotiation and compromise that they did not accept. Their view was to dismiss anybody who didn't adopt their view as unbelievers. So they dismiss other Muslims who were of a different viewpoint as unbelievers, as apostates, and they wanted to effectively kill them as a result. So they were the first radicals in the early 600s, and that was a period, although Islam was rising, in their view it was in decline because it was taking part in a process of negotiation and compromise. So key moments were that period, 600s, 1200s, 1700s, 1900s. And if you go to individual regions, you find variations on a theme, so you'll find peaks and troughs in individual regions as well. So in an overall scheme of things, the Islamic wave of history consists of rises and troughs, but then if you look at a particular area like Southeast Asia, it'll have its own process of rises and troughs as well.
It's interesting when you say the radicals that are coming in. I wonder how much social media or globalization really plays a part in perceived decline or perceived compromise by these radicals. Because, you know, back in the day, they would hear about maybe the caliph's ruling or the pope's ruling or whatever, and then have these, you know, kind of ideas by pamphlet. But today, it's not like that at all. I mean, it's immediate, and you're depending on what website you go to or what news media outlet you go to, you have a different total perception of what's actually going on. So I wonder if this kind of nullifies that idea that the radicals will show the decline, because there's just going to be radicals everywhere because of, you know, just the options that they have, the viewpoints. Yeah,
yeah, it's a good point. I think the whole ease of access to mass media and to the dissemination of knowledge and so forth has cast a completely different context on the question of the tussle for power within, well, different worlds, really. But we're talking about the Islamic world, of course. So will the radicals of the 21st century, will they have the same impact that they had, that the Wahhabis had, for example, in around the turn of the 1800s? Possibly not, because non-radicals are able to track them and oppose them in a way that was not so easy to do in around 1800. So it's a completely different context. You know, we're seeing the Islamic State in the Middle East. We're seeing such radical groups flourish in certain limited contexts. But all those who oppose them have immediate access to what they're doing, and therefore they have immediate, much more immediate ability to stand against them. So we'll see where it leads.
Right, true. Because it used to be with these Islamic radicals, if they were violent, that would be their main, you know, weapon, per se. But now they have to fight battles online too. ISIS is doing that really well, or, you know, trying to radicalize, you know, people from all over. But at the same time, who was it we were talking to about de-radicalization? Was it?
It was Matthew Stone. We haven't released that episode yet, though.
That will be this week. But it's like a whole different front. It's not just a gun, you know, or sword or whatnot, you know, it's more than that now.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's I think the most sort of momentum they can gain is it's not difficult to show up at least a perceived threat, Islam under attack. And I've looked at a few of the recruiting videos, and they're not just, you know, slick in their production. They've actually got some compelling arguments that they make, and they'll even go back all the way to the early councils of the church and talk about the nature of Christ and how, you know, Christianity got it wrong and they made Jesus. And so they're actually making some theological arguments, and then they're making some sociological arguments. And so they're taking the full breadth of what's going on in the world and using it to make compelling arguments to recruit people. And, I think it's actually quite interesting that they've not just looked at it as, well, we have to recruit people theologically. They're looking at it from a political means, sociological means, historical means, you name it, and they seem to be using it for recruitment.
Yeah. Yeah, they certainly are very sophisticated. They've got some very knowledgeable people there, there's no doubt about it, and their whole campaign through the Dabiq magazine and other online promotions is quite impressive in many ways, though horrifying in another way. But where it strikes me that the situation is different in this phase of radicalism in Islam is that, on the one hand, as you say, ISIS are doing, they're putting out that slick advertising, and if that was all they were doing, they might attract a whole lot more support. But at the same time, other Muslims are able to see the reports of the beheadings, of the slave markets, of the Yazidi women, the most horrifying side of what they were doing. So that is a kind of, that insulates some Muslims about from being besotted by the kind of advertising that's going on by ISIS.
Right. It just seems like the most the people that it will mostly reach will be the most desperate or violent minded, which are probably, I mean, maybe for ISIS is what you want, but as for to win over the general population of the world for your cause, it's not going to work.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know if they have hearts and minds at the core of the recruitment, but I think that there has to be people that are wondering and that want this question to be asked. You mentioned the troughs and the peaks, and that when they head down the peak towards the trough, there's a return to the text. You are a textual guy. You're a Quranic exegesis. And so are they returning to the right interpretation of the text?
Mm. The right interpretation of the text.
Somebody's like, yes, he asked it.
Well, one thing I will say from the outset is that as a non-Muslim, I am not going to tell Muslims what is the right interpretation of the text. The bottom line is I know lots of Muslims and I hear from those Muslims different interpretations of the text, so it's not my role to tell them what's right and what's wrong.
Nice sidestep.
Yeah. That's what Howard always says to me. He's like, you're sidestepping. I'm like, I'm not sidestepping. That's reality. I mean, it is. Well, it is true because we don't like it when they do that to us. When somebody says to me, well, you know, Christianity really teaches this. And I'm thinking, whoa, wait a second. You know, this is a very diverse, you know, religion and religious interpretation from the scripture. You know, there's a historical context, there are different viewpoints, and I don't like it when somebody sort of just pigeonholes it and makes it a one sort of, you know, one trick pony. Is that the right analogy there?
Yeah. Well, I agree with you both. I agree with what you've just said, Trevor, but Howard's right in saying it was a nice sidestep. I used to play rugby, and that's where I learned to do the sidestep.
All right, so this show wouldn't be possible without sponsors. And at this point in the show is where, if you want to partner with us, we would put your ad. So if you want to be a part of the show, you want to partner with us.
You like what we're doing.
You want to be on our team, what have you.
Bring this show to the world.
Then email us and let us know.
Peter, aside from your own books, which we're going to put links to in the show notes, any particular reads looking at the history and the relationships between Christians and Muslims or just Muslim history in general that you think our listeners would really benefit from?
Oh, look, there's a lot of stuff out there. I think some of the writing, Ira Lapidus's monumental study of Islamic history, it's been around for a while now, but it's still a very good read, to be honest. I think both Christian writers of Islamic history and secular writers have produced a lot of good stuff out there. I'd point people in his direction in the first instance.
What are your thoughts about Karen Armstrong's books? She's written a lot, and she seems to be quite controversial.
Yeah,
it's more on a popular level.
Yeah,
but worthwhile reads or
well, again, it's. I mean, I don't. I think if Karen Armstrong and I were having a discussion, it would end up being a debate in many kinds of ways. However, with my students, I ensure that when they're reading materials for their studies, I have a range of materials, and I recommend her materials as part of that. I think hers is an important voice. I disagree with it in all kinds of ways, but that's irrelevant in a sense because students need to read a range of viewpoints and to process that information themselves and to reach their own conclusions.
Thank you so much, Peter, for coming in, flying in all the way from Australia.
Yeah, that's right.
Just for us.
We didn't even do our Australian accent.
That's because we don't want to be insulting. thank you for taking the time of being in the studio. We know that your time is precious. You're here teaching at school, and so thank you for doing that for us.
Okay, favorite musician as a bass guitarist? Because I've heard you play the bass. I don't actually know it to be true. It's just rumored around.
All right.
Is it true, first of all? Do you really rock the bass? And who's your favorite musician?
Actually, well, I'm going to have to answer that in a slightly unexpected way from your perspective, in that I'm first and foremost a six-string guitarist, actually. I do bass because that's what they need at church, but I'm more a six-string guitarist. And, jazz guitarists I love, George Benson, Barney Kessel, Joe Pass, some of the older ones. Great players.
Got it. So not like Eddie Van Halen, six string.
Sure.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Thanks, Peter. We really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Great to talk.